madrigal. And four of us, drunk as bees on apple blossoms, sang an incitement to bees to swarm, our breaths mingling across the dinner table, inspire, expire, we share sweet air. Hark, hark, methinks I hear in notes of choice this fairest lady's sweetest mournful voice. That evening piqued my curiosity about bees, and like so many before me, learning more about them, I'm stung. Bees are beings, metaphors, images, sounds, figurations, their indicators, their shape-shifters, and their devices for telling stories. They're important to the story of genetic modification, which I'll refer to as GM throughout the lecture, for not only are they pollinating GM crops and being changed in the process, they're cross-pollinating GM and non-GM crops, showing up humans' arrogance, etc., about control and containment in the shared world, and bees are now themselves being genetically modified. Honey is pure gold. It's golden. We seek it. We love its sweetness, its texture. Honey is pleasure. It's utopia. It stands for lands of milk and honey. Honey comes from bees who represent, for us, among other things, the height of efficiency, organization, industry, diligence, labor, work, worker bees. Bees pollinate a third of our crops, visiting some flowers 15 to 20 times. And they're not the only means of pollination. There's wind, dewdrops, rain, insects, birds, mammals, and gravity, and her surprises. Like the tornado, the twister. Now you all have honey in your hands, and most likely it smells and tastes different than your neighbors. I saw people holding it up and showing it to each other before we started here. Honey is diverse. In fact, there's no generic honey. All honey is particular to the plants that are pollinated then and there at that time. Even if your honey looks similar to your neighbor's honey, it may not be. For instance, organic cucamonga honey looks like blueberry honey and pumpkin and purple loosestrife honey. But it smells and tastes and slides along the glass, it slides along the tongue and down the throat differently. And fireweed honey, which is pale and clear and rich, smells and looks and tastes like nothing else. In this room, we've also honey from bees which have pollinated clover, buckwheat, acacia, wildflower, unnamed, unmarked honey, and honey which claims, romantically, to have been collected in the isolated forests of northern British Columbia, which is pretty sweet. Being newly stung and wanting more, I started hanging around beehives. Can everybody hear me all right? Is the volume okay? Is it too much? Should I put my volume down? Is the mic? Is it better now? I don't know. Just take it off. Is it? Well, maybe I'm going to have to turn down our friends then. You can still hear the feedback? Yeah, where's it? Okay, let's see if I can. How's that? Oh, Lorna.
Is your mic still working?
My mic. Is my mic still working?
Yeah.
Okay. That was it. Did you catch her?
Yeah.
Good. All right, we're all right. Well, Maybe we can turn the bees back on in a little while, but at least we all now have an audio impression of what it's like inside a beehive. The buzz and the bees as well. All right, I'll go back to it then now. Being newly stung and wanting more, I started hanging around beehives. This is the beehive at Strathcona Community Gardens in Chinatown. And I spent a sunny afternoon at a beekeeping workshop with my family. That's my queen bee on the left, and my sister-in-law, honey girl, on the right, and my brother's surgical-looking hands in the yellow. This workshop was led by Surrey beekeeper John Gibault, who showed us how to smoke a hive before opening it. Now, beekeepers smoke hives because it pacifies the bees by making them think that their hive is on fire. What they do when they think their hive is on fire is they dive down and engorge themselves with honey. And then filled up for flight, they get kind of dopey and docile, and then they won't trouble the beekeeper. In the old days, apparently, some beekeepers used to smoke their bees with narcotics. They also used brimstone, which is sulfur, in order to smoke the bees, and bees didn't do too well in that scenario. When the bees are docile, the beekeeper can then run his knife around the frames, slicing through what's called bee space. Bee space is the bee-sized space that bees need to move through. It's about the width of two lifesavers on edge. Once the frame is loosened, you can carefully lift out the frame like that, being careful not to squash or pinch any of the bees. At the end of the workshop, the bee man tipped the full frame of honey, and we dug our fingers right in. Now, I invite you to do so. This is very delicious honey you all have. And that's what you're meant to do with it. So we all dug our fingers right in. Of course, we made great, huge dents in the hive, but the bee man told us that he would replace the frame back into the hive and that in no time at all, the bees would completely repair the dents. You wouldn't be able to see where we'd stuck our fingers in at all. Now, if you look in this test tube, you can see how slowly honey flows. Some of yours might flow more quickly than others, but generally honey flows really, really slowly. Air bubbles are suspended in it, time looks slowed, and honey and honeybees seem timeless. Now here's some book learning about bees. Bees have intrigued, sweetened, and stung us for millennia. The earliest honeybee's fossil has been found is 50 million years old. And since then, their honey's been pinched by baboons, honey ants, gorillas, chimps, honey buzzards, rhesus monkeys, bears, humans, and woodpeckers, who use their long, sharp-pointed beaks to enter the hive and extract their prey with their very long, sticky tongues. Over time and place, honeybees have been cultivated in all manner of hives. And I'll just show you a few. This is from a huge encyclopedia of the history of beekeeping. So here's some that are kept inside a hollowed-out tree. These are called skeps. And here's also some skeps. You can see how the honeycomb looks on the inside. Here's somebody who's slicing off some comb in a more natural or organic shape. Now, in Europe in the 1600s, this cultivation showed in new hive genres. And this is a hive that was designed by Christopher Wren, who was the architect who rebuilt London after the Great Fire of 1666. And in 1659, the English diarist and garden writer John Evelyn proposed a transparent beehive. which would resemble palaces, towers, and fortresses with domes and Corinthian pillars. And, as he wrote, statues and busts, as you will have it, more or less magnificent. Evelyn pictured some hives turning about like windmills, and others like a great hollow head, with the mouth the bee's entry. And likewise, these building facades in England had secret entrances for bees. The bees would fly into the mouth of a lion in the upper image. Do you see the lion below the sundial? So they would fly into the mouth of the lion, just below Samson's carved riddle, which is out of the strong come forth sweetness. They'd fly up a tube to hive in earthenware jars, which were stashed underneath an upper window seat. And in the photo below, bees would reach their hives in an upstairs bedroom through holes in the facade of this building, which was then the Nag's Head Inn. Bees are invited to enter Science World through a gigantic flower, which is at the front of the building. I don't know if anybody's seen that, yeah? And I wonder, too, if they've got other routes in. This is my modest proposal for genetically modified bees, which would live and hive inside the heating and ventilation systems of buildings. And I figure that they would be piqued by the scent of avaricious greed, at which point they would seal off the ventilation systems and the people inside would come outside into the shared air. If anybody knows how I can make these, let me know. In the 1700s, hives took on the look of cabinets with flat planes and precise angles, hinged doors on paneled chambers. This went along with schematics for describing and predicting bee movements and plans for improving and further rationalizing bees' work. In short, capitalizing on bees' ways. Glass panels and hive walls, which John Evelyn had proposed, made panoptical observation hives where bees' organization, their productivity, their efficiency, and their profitability could be surveyed and measured. You've probably seen an observation hive, maybe the one at Science World, and if not, there's a huge new observation hive in Surrey that's going to be opening at the end of February. I think it's supposed to be the largest one in North America. In the late 1700s, a blind Swiss naturalist named Huber devised what he called leaf hives, and they were structured like books, hinged at their spine for easily examining, and in his case, for easily touching both sides of the frame. Huber worked with the devoted help of his wife, Maria, another honey girl, and his son. And he wrote, this is a quote, "Opening the different divisions in succession, we daily inspected both surfaces of every comb. There was not a single cell where we could not see distinctly whatever passed at all times, nor a single bee. I may almost say, and without which we were not particularly acquainted." Sorry, I read that wrong. Let me do it again. "There was not a single cell where we could not see distinctly whatever passed at all times, nor a single bee, I may almost say, with which we were not particularly acquainted." So perhaps you can hear strains of Michel Foucault's voice echoing through this archive, this way of being. In the mid-1800s, there were hives. This one's called a nut hive, divined by a nut, someone named Nut, shaped like scientific apparatus with clear glass jars, spell jars, exhibiting pure virgin honey. And that one was prominently displayed in the windows of shops in Cambridge in England. And then in 1851, an American named Langstroth put some finishing touches on this project by recognizing the real value of the principle of bee space. Now remember that bee space is about the width of a bee. It's about 3/8 of an inch. And it's the space that bees leave unstuck around a comb. It's the shared air that bees move and mingle through. Langstroth patented bee space and designed hives with movable frames that were hung like folders in standardized filing cabinets. These hives are easy to manage since they're less gummed up with sticky bee life. If beekeepers don't observe the principle of bee space, what they get is a box, which is a sealed box of golden honey that the bees absolutely completely sealed shut from the inside. So you can see how movable frame was a real innovation for beekeeping. All right, so this really took off. Now, here's a woman who's learning how to transfer bees from an old-fashioned box hive into a movable frame hive. And the text says, even womankind can undergo the ordeal. This is from 1927. Now, it's a good thing that even womankind can manage it because, of course, queen bees are female and worker bees are female. Though, of course, there is an important role for boy bees, drones, too. Now, there's a song that goes with this, of course, isn't there? And it's, let me tell you about the birds and the bees. Here's a honey gal whose swarm has settled on the post behind her. Soon she'll sweep these bees into her apron or into a tablecloth. She'll wrap them up and she'll coax them into her new hive. So I guess you're getting the picture that beekeeping culture is dripping with human culture, to say the least. They run together. With the new movable frame hives, honey could be more easily moved and removed, and beekeeping was mobilized and commercialized in a way that was only dreamt of by some during the early Enlightenment. You know all about blind beekeepers already, don't you? Honeybees were transported to the so-called New World by British and French colonists, first seen swarming off a shipwreck off the coast of Bermuda in 1617. And they were also seen that year by Welsh settlers in Britain's colony of Newfoundland. Nowadays, caravans of migratory beekeepers migrate with their bees. They haul hives across country, following seasonal crops that need pollinating to make money, honey, and to make up for declining bee populations, without whom, we'd lose our lands of milk and honey. Honeybees' lives correspond with and are implicated in migrations, revolutions, colonizations, and globalizations, including the currently phrased globalization of terrorism. Now, here's a newspaper clipping from a couple of weeks ago. U.S. moves on honey producers. Treasury Department implicates suppliers in Bin Laden's financial supply network. And I'll just read the first little bit of this. It says, honey, a Middle Eastern staple whose curative value Islam's prophet Muhammad equated with reading the Quran, has been implicated in the guns, drugs, and money network that supports Osama bin Laden and his group. As well as using honey to generate income, the 55-gallon barrels of bulk honey were used to hide guns, cash, and contraband because they are unwieldy and messy to inspect. Sticky wickets, sticky fingers. In fact, bees have long played a part in warfare. In 300 BC, writer Tacitus wrote about bees being released into mines, into tunnels, leading to important destinations. In 1500 BC, in Asia Minor, the penalty for stealing bees was being exposed to the stinging of bees. In England, in the early 1100s, prisoners, naked and rubbed with honey, were exposed to the burning heat of the sun, thereby exciting flies and other insects of that kind to sting them. Unsuspecting chins have tripped tripwires, releasing angry swarms from hidden hives, which might contain 10,000 or 20,000 bees. Indian bandits used ferocious bees to guard loot stashed in mountain caves. English smugglers hid contraband under empty hives, smearing honey around them to keep customs officers at bay. a migratory beekeeper, declared, "I know from my experiences in moving bees for pollination that a hive or two, even empties, sitting in the back of your truck is a great theft deterrent." Microscopic documents were gummed to bees' wings and flown across enemy lines by the Japanese and the English during World War II. And from the Middle Ages on, hives containing bees were dropped, hurled, or projected over fortress walls. And more recently, honey-loving teddy bears were catapulted over the Wall of Shame in Quebec City, the FTAA's Wall of Shame. In short, bees are figures of their time. They've interested folks like Aristotle, who thought that honey fell from the sky. Pliny, who felt that honey was sweat of the heavens, saliva of the stars. And Zeus, who as an infant was hidden in a cave and fed honey from sacred bees. And Zeus was raised on milk and honey. Now we're talking about Zeus, the big daddy of Greek gods here, not Dr. Seuss, maker-upper of novel life forms, novel figures, cautionary tales, and fanciful plots. We're talking about Zeus, not Dr. Seuss, or even Dr. Zhu, the Chinese genetic engineer who was the first in 1985 to genetically modify fish. Tellingly, he chose the goldfish. And this is a text, I'm just going to read it. This is, of course, from One Fish, Two Fish. "Who am I? My name is Ish, and on my hand I have a dish. I have this dish to help me wish. When I wish to make a wish, I wave my hand, and with a big swish, swish, then I say, I wish for fish. And I get fish right on my dish. And this, ladles and gentle spoons, is genetic engineering." What are genetically modified organisms? They're new life forms which contain genes transferred from one species or strain to another. They often cross established boundaries between kingdoms or queendoms, for instance, between insects and plants, and mammals and bacteria, and birds and fish. They have lots of names. They're called GM, which stands not for General Motors, but for genetic modification. GE, again, not General Electric, but genetically engineered. LMOs, living modified organisms. Bioengineered organisms. New life forms, recombinants, transgenic organisms, and novel life forms. And that last one's my favorite because I really like novels. Sometimes it seems like these novel life forms are just part of Darwin's story of evolution, part of constant change. We all know nothing is constant save change, and all that is solid melts into air. Organisms have been changing, adapting, evolving, biodiversifying, selected, bred, crossbred, hybridized, grafted, and generally flummoxing purity for years. And purity is a very political concept. We've imagined utopian lands of milk and honey, pure golden honey, and these musings usually prefigure unexpected minglings, rises, falls, tumbles, accidents, mistakes, and escapes. For instance, fish are being inserted with human growth hormones. Perhaps you've heard about this already. This is to make them grow big quick. Then researchers, after doing this, discovered that if they were released to mate with wild fish, they could cause species extinction. And those slippery little devils have, haven't they? Millions of GM fish escaped into the Atlantic from offshore farms in Europe and America in 1999. They've been mating with wild salmon, polluting the gene pool, and producing hybrid fish that can't survive in the open ocean. And researchers modifying a Japanese fish called Medaka with human growth hormone found that a third of these fish die before reaching reproductive age. And using computer modeling, they projected that if 60 genetically engineered Medaka fish were released into a wild population of 60,000, it would take 40 generations for the species to become extinct. So in this narrative of identity and reproduction, I think we're being set up to feel grateful to so-called terminator technologies. And these are bioengineering technologies that produce sterile organisms, so organisms that can't reproduce. If only they didn't mingle, inspire, expire, share air or water. Through us, imagined and living figurations mingle. I imagine you've heard about the new farm animals, it's PHARM animals, and they're human-made living chemical factories that are referred to as bioreactors. They're transgenic pigs, cows, sheep, chicken, and goats, which produce pharmaceuticals. And they produce them in their eggs, their semen, or their milk. Here's Dr. Seuss again, If I Ran the Zoo. This is from 1950. The Canadian company Nexia has patented the BELE goat system. BELE stands for Breed Early, Lactate Early. So the BELE goat system for producing what they're calling BioSteel milk. And BioSteel milk is a new super strong patented product that's made from the milk of these transgenic spider goats. Are you with me? Nexia has been working with the Canadian Armed Forces and the U.S. Army to produce BELE, let's call them belly goats, to produce these belly goat system BioSteel milk performance fibers, and the first destination for them is soft body armor. They say that, the Nexia publicity says that initial industrial niches to be targeted include ballistic protection for military and law enforcement personnel and products requiring high linear tension fibers. So you can see these billy goats, belly goats, in the bottom right corner of Magruder Zoo. See them there, two of them facing each other? It looks like the spider genes have congregated in their tails, that is, and they're weaving some kind of web, or Charlotte's web. And see the creature dancing on their horns? Everybody see it okay? Yeah? Well, that is Dr. Jeff Turner, who's the head of Nexia. Now, Dr. Turner has been quoted saying, he's been quoted saying this, printed, I've read it several times, quote, spider silk is neat material the world wants. Can we make this in goats? And he responded to his own question by genetically engineering and patenting it, or is it them? Dr. Turner says, again quoting him, we feed a goat hay, corn, and water, and she produces a recombinant spider silk in her milk. Just to the left of the goats, you can see, with it leaning over the edge there, you can see there's an EnviroPig, EnviroPig TM, trademark. And that's a Canadian pig who has the genes of mice and bacteria inserted so that it, she, or he can digest the phosphorus in their feed rather than pooping it out into the waterways where it's a toxic polluter. So that's got to be good. This amazing zoo image is part of a long-standing project of gathering, collecting, containing, instrumentalizing, and exhibiting racial or racialized subjects. What's on offer at Magruder Zoo, Zeus, Dr. Seuss, Dr. Zoo? See all the means of separation and connection in this image. There's cages, you can see just on the upper right. There's cages with rungs that are wide enough to drive through. Open-air pools. There's an escape hatch in the bottom left, an escape hatch in a triumphal arch, which I think is such a figure. There's mingling going on all over the place in this image, in ways that we know and in ways that we don't yet. Yet we, as inheritors of the Enlightenment Project, shape what's not known through what we reckon is known. And genetically engineered organisms are new, unknown, adaptable, unrecallable, proliferating life forms. Geneticist Dr. David Suzuki states that, this is a quote, once the genie is out of the bottle, it will be very difficult or impossible to stuff it back. Genetically modified plants are living organisms. Once these new forms of life have become established in our surroundings, they can replicate, change, and spread, so there may be no turning back. Many ecologists are concerned about what this means to the balance of life on Earth. End quote. Now it's time for another song. And the same thing happens with the birds and the bees as they flit among the flowers as they nestle in the trees. Yes, the same thing happens with the birds and the bees, and it's happening to us tonight. ...1956 was the year this song came out. And it was also the same year that the same thing happened with some tropical bees. That year, a geneticist in Brazil transported some queen bees from Africa in the hopes of creating a superior honeybee, one better suited to the tropical climates of Brazil. But they escaped quarantine and mated and hybridized with the locals, and they're migrating northward. Here one's joined McGrew Zoo. You can see it in the crack there. That's Eric the Alpha Bee. You see it in the middle of the crack. Now, the popular name for these beings is killer bees, and they often enter honeybees' colonies to mingle and to mate with them. Oh, and while they're there, they kill the honeybee's queen as well. Such mating results in more hybrid bees having killer bee genes and tendencies, and an entire resulting colony may suddenly take on aggressive and short-tempered behavior. So says the literature. While calling them killer bees creates some panic, their other name, which is Africanized honeybees, sets them up to corroborate with racist characterizations. They're described in the literature as violent, threatening, promiscuous, queen-killing, hive-stealing, house-invading, etc., yet they look just like honeybees. And in fact, it says over and over again, only experts can tell them apart. So you tell me, is this a killer bee or a friendly Apis mellifera? Meanwhile, I don't know how to feel about killer bees colonizing the strip in Las Vegas, viciously attacking and pursuing perceived enemies for great distances around their hives, which are tucked in cracks in strip walls. Apparently, these killer bees in Las Vegas often swarm and cluster around picnic tables. Now, this story that I've just recounted, this history, is both true and untrue for bees around the world, living with different non-human and human cultures, with different values, now and before, live and are described in every way. And there are still some wild, feral bees. But this history does tell the story of the Western Enlightenment Project, which we're part of and which we're implicated in, and which values what we've got bees representing, and that is industry, efficiency, diligence, organization, standardization, labor, work, worker bees, and which has underneath it a strong commitment to, and perhaps more importantly, a strong belief in progress, improvability, and in the instrumental use of what we call nature and what we call natural resources, including living organisms, for some humans' benefit. So, how are the honeybees faring in all this? Now, I just have to turn this up a bit for a minute here, just so you can, maybe we can tolerate them for 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. soundtrack that we're listening to was made at Strathcona Green Gardens in Chinatown. It's a warm and sunny day, so I lounged on the grass, listening in at an indecent level, just like this. I cranked up the volume on my headset as loud as I could, and I went in. When bees swarm, older female bees, older women avant-garde bees, go on ahead looking for a good place for the swarming golden throng to hive, and those bees are called scout bees. And they estimate the size of the cavity that they're inspecting by walking all over its surfaces. This is just what the bees did with my microphone that day at the gardens. They walked all over it. They paused, they wiggled, they flew away, came back, buzzed off. They interacted. Bees are being used as canaries in worldly mines to measure toxic chemicals. They're efficient, economical biomonitoring tools for assessing the environmental risks of hazardous substances. New computerized hives are being installed at toxic waste sites to measure contaminant exposures, since bees nicely exhibit the bioaccumulation of toxic chemicals. Bees in Victoria showed that airborne arsenic from a Tacoma copper smelter traveled further than was previously reported. Bees are interacting with whatever's up, with toxins, pesticides, genetically modified insecticides, deforestation, land development, changing farm practices, general environmental degradation, new life forms, the whole ball of wax. Bees are living metaphoric figurations. They get to register how involved and how entangled we are in biotechnology. We inhabit bees and bees inhabit we's, who are part of, implicated in, stung, and active and hopeful. Pollinating crops that feed us, that keep us alive, bees gather and distribute, contaminate and mutate, and become transgenic organisms. They sting the feed trough, which glides me along, lurchingly, mouthful by implicating mouthful. I'm in this right to the tip of my stung tongue. The one in my mouth. New research shows that bacteria in the mouth can take up foreign DNA and express the genes. So bacteria in your mouth can take up foreign DNA and it can express those genes. Also, that transformable bacteria are also present in the respiratory tract, and that farm workers and food handlers who are exposed to transgenic DNA in dust and pollen are at risk. Researchers have found that a virus, which is commonly used in order to genetically modify organisms, it's used in the lab process. It's called the cauliflower mosaic virus, 35S promoter, or CAMV, that this virus, this tool, has interchangeable components with the HIV virus, that it's prone to recombination events. That means it's mutable. It likes to change shape. It's a shapeshifter. And that if CAMV and HIV meet, they could combine into new chimeric viruses. This can happen if pollen from a GM plant is inhaled by someone who's HIV positive or has AIDS. No bee sneezes, this bee sneezes, repercusses, rezones, rebounds. In the south of France, researchers are finding direct effects of transgenic crops on bees' foraging behavior. Traces of GMOs have been found in honey and honeycomb in Oxfordshire, England, where government GM trial crops were grown in 1999. And this pollen created genes which are resistant to a weed killer that's produced by the Life Sciences Corporation, Aventis. None of you that I know of have that honey in your hands, at least right now, but you may have arrived with it in your belly already. Now, some of the honey that I handed to you, that we handed to you, might be stuck to the edge of your cuffs, to the heels of your hands. It might even be dribbling down your chin or stickily sealing your lips. Now, I meant to sing A Taste of Honey, but it's just too bad, so I'm not going to. Maybe somebody else would like to sing it. Despite the popular saying, you are what you eat, it's surprising to discover that inside the guts of some honeybees, genes for herbicide resistance are being transferred across species barriers. I'll just say that again. Inside the guts of some honeybees, genes are traveling across species barriers. A professor in Germany, a fellow named Katz, fed young honeybees pollen from genetically modified canola produced by Agrivo. Again, an unbelievable name. While later examining their intestines, Professor Katz found that the herbicide-resistant gene had transferred into bacteria and yeast. This is inside the guts of honeybees. Run-of-the-mill genes do jump. This is called horizontal gene transfer. But Katz's research is significant because he traced transgenic herbicide-resistant genes jumping in bees' guts, which suggests that bacteria in human digestive systems could also do the same. We're swallowing intimacy and distance by the tender mouthful, swallowing swallowers, carriers, contaminants, mutants, and perhaps becoming so ourselves. Intended and non-intended, we're the cumulative impact of all these contamination experiences which travel the world, meeting in some belted middle, maybe yours, maybe succulently served at a belt-loosening dinner party, where we drizzle GM organisms onto our sweet honey cakes and swirl it into our ambrosia. Time for another song. Where the bees suck, there suck I. In a cowslip's bell I lie. Lots of food is changing lately, and I don't mean those science experiments that we all have in the back of our fridge. I'd like to tell you a few GM stories about these four food groups. I'll be quite quick with these, but it's just to let you know the range. If you're not already knowledgeable. The apple, in the lower left there, the apple, of course, is a figure for knowledge. It's a figure for consuming knowledge. From Adam and Eden to Apple Mac computers to an apple a day keeps the doctor away, apples are choice food, but there's one thing that's wrong with them. They brown when you cut them, but no more, because Okanagan Biotechnology, Inc., of Summerland, they think that this is unattractive to consumers, so they're right now engineering apples that won't brown. So it's fruit that won't show that it's interacting with the air. This trope for knowledge won't look dated, it won't look situated, and I guess by extension, time won't pass and history will be circumvented. But here's a reminder. Here's Chicken Little, who was hit on the head with some sky is falling kind of knowledge, which she tries to tell her mates about, but the wise owl sets her straight and encourages her to eat it before the others come back for it, take it away from her. And there she is, eating it all up. The item on the lower right is, of course, the beautiful tofu. Vegetarians love soy. We prefer it to meat joy. So let's move on to tofu. Some tofu is labeled GM-free, while others is organic. But organic farmers have lots to worry about these days. They might say, Me, I like to keep to myself. I know the world mingles. I've got my own shelf. My bees are so smarmy, they stick tight at home. Next door to GMOs, I'm sure they ne'er roam. With costs undeniable, crops uncertifiable, I bite my lip. The sitch is quite friable. In the mid-1990s, Iowa's Pioneer Hybrid International, which is the world's largest seed company, produced genetically engineered soybeans that were spliced with Brazil nut genes, and this was to make them more protein rich. But people allergic to Brazil nuts were then put at risk, as they wouldn't likely think to look to see whether the tofu they were eating had the allergens in it. Apparently a lot of people are allergic to Brazil nuts. Now, some people were very, their faith was increased in the regulatory system when researchers discovered this and this particular product was recalled. However, other people really wondered why on earth the Pioneer Hybrid had gone ahead with this research to start off with. So, quite a lot of ambivalence there. Soy is the ingredient which is most associated with genetically modified foods. Health complaints caused by soy increased by 50% in 1998 in the UK when soy was named one of the top 10 foods to cause allergic reactions in consumers. Researchers commented, quote, "We believe this raises serious new questions about the safety of GM foods because it's impossible to guarantee that the soya used in the test was GM-free. So how will this food affect infants, people who are sick, the elderly, all of whom are more susceptible to autoimmune problems, diseases, and also to allergic reactions?" So we'll leave tofu for now. It's the American Soy Association, if you go and look at it online, makes for very interesting reading. They're really, really advocating for GM soy. So let's go on to the potatoes now. One potato, two potato, three potato. These ones aren't, I don't think, but they could be Monsanto's New Leaf Y potatoes. 2 years ago, the Canadian government fast-tracked them for approval. This was after they'd been held up in the government regulatory process because Monsanto refused to provide key scientific information to regulators assessing the product's health and environmental effects. The deal, they say, was not arrived at easily because Monsanto refused to sign an agreement allowing all parties to talk openly about confidential business information. And this is something that comes up over and over again in this literature. Companies protect themselves by citing confidential business information. And then that way they're legally able to keep their lips stickily sealed. It's a very important problem. The company, however, eventually agreed to a verbal waiver. The Canadian government inspections of past confined field trials, which had been conducted by Monsanto, showed that the company performed poorly. And as a result, the government was concerned that Monsanto would not be able to adequately manage larger field trials. Yet this New Leaf Wise potatoes has now gone through. Right, next, Lands of Milk and Honey. Delicious, frothy milk, milkshakes, milk in a revolving door. In 1989, Monsanto was aware that cows in test herds treated with their genetically engineered bovine growth hormone, it's usually referred to as RBGH, that these cows developed sores and lesions on their udders that were collectively called mastitis. Dairy farmers inject their cows with this hormone every 2 weeks, and this is to increase the cow's output. And now Bessie's milk contained increased levels of pus, blood, and virulent bacteria, and consequently increased levels of antibiotics. In order to deal with this problem, Monsanto's top dairy scientist, a woman named Margaret Miller, left the firm and became the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's Monsanto plant. Once at the FDA, Dr. Miller arbitrarily changed the existing antibiotic standards. She increased by 100 times the allowable level of antibiotics that farmers could put into milk. And then in 1993, there was another revolving door milkshake. Now, I can't quite tell if this is Bessie the cow or Dolly the sheep or the belly goat, But anyway, in 1993, another Monsanto employee went to work for the US FDA, oversaw the approval process for this recombinant bovine growth hormone, rotated then back to Monsanto. And researchers are finding risks, and they have for a long time been finding links between RBGH and human cancers, especially prostate cancer, which is very worrying considering how much milk so many children drink. All right, now, there was a syringe in the middle of that plate, so let's just talk about that for a second. Maybe you're an informed and health-conscious person, and you're choosing not to eat any of these foods that I've just shown, not to add them to the mingle in your gut. Maybe you're pushing away this plate and even hoping not to be implicated, but GM food isn't the only substance that's concerned. There's also the medicines we take. For instance, if you're diabetic, you may be on the cleverly named human insulin, which Aventis and Novo Nordisk introduced in 1985. It was the first genetically engineered drug to be used on people, ever. And it's been found to increase the frequency of hypoglycemia because it can suppress warning signs, and it may result in what's been dubbed dead in bed syndrome, and that's from the insulin news. Now, I don't think I'm all that easy to shock anymore, and I'm not a spring chicken little. But I am disturbed that this is being described as a syndrome. How often is it happening? And is the GE insulin known to be responsible for it? Why doesn't my diabetic friend know about it? Why hasn't his doctor informed him? And why hasn't he asked his doctor about it? Are researchers looking into it? And which researchers? And does this matter? And what does that mean? Is it true that the medical and biotech interests are buying up all the traditionally used animal insulin while they flood the market with their patented GE insulin product? How can the effects of GE insulin be isolated from other possibly interacting contributors within the diabetic body? These questions and this knowledge can certainly leave a bad taste in your mouth, so why not reach for a mint? They're always available in supermarket checkout counters, and these ones are made with Monsanto's NutraSweet aspartame. And what's aspartame made of? Genetically modified bacteria. You might be one of millions of people who saves a little money by using a supermarket loyalty card. And I'm not sure. Oh, sorry, I missed a slide. Right, a supermarket loyalty card. The slides seem to be going out of focus. Now, I hope you'll notice that I've altered this for copyright reasons. I dabbed a little bit of lipstick on the whey part of Safe Whey. I'm not sure if this is happening in Canada, but last summer, the UK Food Standards Agency and the UK Department of Health said that they'll be using the records that are provided by these loyalty cards to test the effects of GE food on consumers. Consumption patterns will be linked to data regarding the number of birth defects or increased cases of cancer, diabetes, and other diseases such as chronic illnesses and allergies. At least 20 laboratories are set to carry out these checks. Now, as I say, I don't know if this is happening in Canada, but it's definitely happening in the UK. And this is a postcard that was produced by the Council of Canadians last year. You are really having focus problems. It's just about time to change the carousel anyway. This says, anyway, genetically engineered foods are a frightening experiment, and we refuse to be your guinea pigs. This postcard had a text on the back, and it was permanently addressed to Alan Rock. Oh, yeah, maybe you could... Oh, actually, I don't need to change the carousel, do I? We'll just start the other one. Okay, here we go. How are you doing? All right? Okay. All right, so while GMOs created in labs may be contained, isolated, and kept separate, like the honey in your test tubes, but maybe with a comforting stopper in it. In as us, in the world, we they mingle. And how, we don't know. But medical folks are anticipating new so-called side effects cropping up, such as novel diseases. Here's Winnie with a novel disease. The British Medical Association released a report 2 years ago. The report was called The Impact of GM on Agriculture, Food, and Health. And they said in it, and I quote, disease surveillance and event monitoring procedures will need to be sufficiently robust to deal with the potential emergence of new diseases associated with GM material, which will be obscure and difficult to diagnose. And how about the health of the novel life forms? How will they fare? Will the folks who created them watch out for them? How will they take care of themselves? What will happen to them when they proliferate? And what will happen to all of us along with them? Around here, human eaters, I mean humans who eat, have been spoon-fed the idea that we have the right to choose what we eat. The concept of consumer choice relies on being able to get accurate information and having the real possibility of acting on it, whether or not either of these take place. However, the concept of consumer choice can obscure the fact that for most of us, unlike apples, money just doesn't grow on trees, and we eat what we can afford to eat. This is an old honey extractor. You take the combs out of the hive and put them in the center and spin it. Spin the handle. And here's what the honeycomb looks like when the honey's been extracted from it. Poverty and crisis make good customers for the GE food, which choosy consumers reject. And it's not just about the distribution of poverty nationally. It's a global thing. It's said that in order to make a pound of honey, a honeybee would have to travel the equivalent of the circumference of the earth 3 times around. Imagine her circling the globe along any meridian, making equatorial spins along uneddying channels where the world is divided neatly north and south. Now I'll just read you a small paragraph, which is a report from a UK newspaper, The Independent, from last summer. Quote, hundreds of thousands of tons of GM food rejected by European consumers are being dispatched to the world's poorest people by USAID and UN World Food Programs. It's being seen as a way of bailing out US farmers who are growing GM crops produced by companies like Monsanto, but have now found their markets disappearing through a widespread refusal to buy them, end quote. Wolfgang Samos is the head of the Novartis Agribusiness Division, and he said, if there is enough demand for GMO-free food, then a GMO-free market will develop. You could go to Hungary for non-genetically modified maize and to Brazil for GMO-free soybeans. That was reported in the Dow Jones in March of 1998. I wonder, though, who's the you who could go? And who, capital W, capital H, capital O, who is at the table making these dinner deals? At the table, swarms of agricultural, biotech, life science, pharmaceutical corporations like, I'm sure these names will be familiar to you, Novartis, Monsanto, Agrivo, Aventis, DuPont, AstraZeneca, Advanta, Dow, Cargill, Cyanamid, and their ilk, there's more. And governments are joined by global trade bodies like the World Trade Organization, which is one of four international organizations meant to set international food standards and legislation. So the WTO sits with the World Health Organization, WHO, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and also the Codex Alimentarius Commission, which is funded by the FAO and the WHO. Along with these bodies and us everyday eaters, there's lots of other players in the biotech new world order. It's been said that transgenics is the science of this new world order. There's military industrial